Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, hosting the show today. Glad you could listen. During this hour of the program, we'll talk about the role of nitrogen in both agriculture and in global climate change. Our guest is Pamela Madsen. She is director of the Earth Systems Program in the School of Earth Sciences at Stanford University, where she has taught since 1997. Pamela Madsen is an ecologist and biogeochemist, and her research focuses on the effects of human-caused changes on biogeochemical cycling and trace gas exchange in tropical forests and agricultural systems. And we'll talk about what that means during this hour. Dr. Madsen has conducted field research around the world with economists and agronomists analyzing the economic and environmental impacts of land use decisions in agricultural systems in the developing world, and finding alternative practices that are better economically and environmentally. The focus of her work as a scientist is biogeochemistry. That's a great word, and we'll talk about that during this hour. She's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and a recipient of a NASA Exceptional Service Medal and also a MacArthur Fellowship in 1995. Later today, she'll be presenting a lecture in the Procter & Gamble Company Lecture Series in the School of Integrative Biology at 4 o'clock in room B102 of the Chemical and Life Sciences Laboratory, 601 South Goodwin in Urbana. That's a lot of information, so I'll try to repeat that later on. We're glad to have her talking with us during this hour of Focus 580. If you have questions on the topic, we'll try to lay out some of the basics and invite your participation. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and that's 333-WILL, if that makes it easier to dial. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other Midwestern states, 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL locally, elsewhere 800-222-WILL. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure. Happy to be here.
Well, let me ask you to begin by discussing your focus on nitrogen and its role in agriculture and the problems it can pose for ecosystems and, I guess, the global environment.
Sure. Well, let me start by saying that nitrogen is an element that we all need, all living things need, and plants need quite a bit of it. It's a really critical part of their photosynthetic machinery. It's how they grow. Animals need it in amino acids and proteins and enzyme systems, and we all need quite a bit of it. We're literally bathed in it. The atmosphere is 78% dinitrogen, and yet that nitrogen isn't available to most of us. Some microbes have the ability to get at it, and through them, all of the rest of us organisms on Earth gain access to available forms of nitrogen. And that means that many ecosystems, many habitats, forests and grasslands and different types of systems around the world have adapted to growing under very low amounts of nitrogen. We've been lucky, I guess that you can say, in that we've learned how to fix that dinitrogen from the atmosphere using fossil fuel energy, using the energy from oil and gas and coal. It's a quite energy-intensive process, but we're able to take that unavailable form, dinitrogen in the atmosphere, converted into forms that then we can give to plants and allow plants to grow. And that's really been a critical factor in our ability to increase food production at a rate that is sufficient to keep pace with human population growth over the last 30 or 40 years. So fertilizer, nitrogen has played a very important role in that. And a large share of the world's population is alive today because we've had that nitrogen. So it's very important, but at the same time, there have been some unintended consequences of our ability to fix nitrogen, both for fertilizers and also, I should mention, we also inadvertently fix nitrogen from the atmosphere to available forms when we burn fossil fuels, when we drive cars. But there are some unintended results of that additional nitrogen in the system, and those unintended results are leading to nitrogen pollution of air and water that have human health consequences, but also affect ecosystems, affect coastal estuaries and bays, and other kinds of systems that we love. So that's raised concerns for us.
I believe I read somewhere yesterday in trying to come up with some clues about the topic that human activity has essentially doubled the amount of available nitrogen in the biosphere.
That's right, through both fixing nitrogen for fertilizers and fossil fuel burning in cars, and that some nitrogen makes its way in through lightning fixation. That's a natural process. Other nitrogen makes its way in through biological nitrogen fixation, another natural process. But we've added on top of that all of the nitrogen that we fix for fertilizers and all of the nitrogen that's fixed when we drive cars and burn oil and gas. And so, yes, we've doubled the amount of available nitrogen in the global system. And unfortunately, nitrogen doesn't stay where we put it. It tends to hopscotch around the globe through a number of different ways. It moves in water, it moves through the air in a number of different forms. And that's the cause of the problems that we're worried about. Those are the inadvertent consequences of that additional nitrogen. The Mississippi River right now is carrying twice as much nitrogen as it did when I was a child, and you know, in the late 50s and early 60s. Mm-hmm. So it's doubling. It doubled during that period of time. We're putting lots of nitrogen into the atmosphere in the form of NOx. It's called. It's a gas that is critical to the production of smog. Mm-hmm. And that NOx is being emitted from fossil fuel burning, from driving of cars especially, and also some from agricultural fluxes of nitrogen. And that atmospheric change is leading to air pollution, leading to also the emissions of nitrous oxide, a greenhouse gas, mm-hmm. and that's where we have this connection with climate change. And the movement then of nitrogen through the air being deposited downwind causes acidification of streams and rivers and forests. And it also adds extra nitrogen, inadvertently fertilizes those ecosystems, just like the movement of nitrogen through the waterways inadvertently fertilizes downstream ecosystems. And it's that inadvertent fertilization that's causing problems in some ecosystems around the world, like our estuaries, like the Gulf of Mexico or the Chesapeake Bay. Something like two-thirds of our coastal baylands and estuaries in the United States have been impacted by nitrogen that's coming off of the land and moving through the river systems or through the air into the coastal ecosystems, and that's changing them. It's driving them to low oxygen conditions that ultimately drive away fish or kill shellfish that can't swim away. Mm-hmm. So there are negative consequences there that actually hit us in the pocketbook as well as, you know, health concerns. And then there are concerns about deposition effects in forests and grasslands, too.
So just speaking of the estuary issue, there's in recent years been a great deal of concern about the large and growing, described as a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, mm-hmm. at the mouth of the Mississippi River for this very reason.
Yeah, the dead zone is a term that's been used for this very large and growing area of low oxygen conditions in the bottom waters of the Gulf of Mexico. And this is an area that spreads along the Louisiana and Texas coastlines. And it's actually, in the recent years, been a huge area, you know, the size of New Jersey. And in this situation, the bottom waters have very low oxygen and driving away or killing the fishes and shellfish. And it affects the industry that relies on those. What's happening there is that nutrients that are moving down the Mississippi in fresh water in the spring are flowing into the Gulf of Mexico, and they're basically fertilizing the system, allowing very rapid rates of growth by the algae, the phytoplankton that live in those coastal waters. That phytoplankton dies, sinks, and is, in the bottom waters, decomposed by microorganisms. And those microorganisms consume oxygen out of the low waters, the bottom waters. Ultimately, then, there is not enough replenishment of oxygen from the top to the bottom, and the bottom waters become very anoxic or have very low oxygen conditions. And so it's a complex situation. Mm-hmm. It's controlled in part by the shape and the form of the Gulf of Mexico itself. But the nutrients flowing down the Mississippi are feeding that phytoplankton growth and allowing that anoxic or low oxygen condition to develop in the spring and summer.
So as you say, it's a complex system. It's a case where something happens that causes something else that causes something else
that's
to
right.
happen, and we're just
maybe
finding
miles
out.
Away.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the difficulty with nitrogen. The effects are often far distant from the source of the input, the source of the problem. In the case of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, that nitrogen and phosphorus also, but mostly nitrogen, is moving down the Mississippi River from a number of different places and a number of different sources. You know, we have nitrogen coming in sewage effluents from all of our big cities in the Mississippi Basin. We have nitrogen coming in from animal waste, from runoff from agriculture, from deposition of nitrogen into the basin, this huge Mississippi Basin. And all of those together are contributing to that flux of nitrogen to the ocean. In the case of the Mississippi, most of it is probably around 50% or maybe a little more is thought to be from agricultural runoff. But there are lots of players in this.
Sure. Well, in the case of agriculture, the application of anhydrous ammonia as a fertilizer, especially in corn and wheat,
mm-hmm.
Not necessarily in soybeans because they fix their own nitrogen.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Is thought to be a large contributing factor to this. But it's also a subject of considerable controversy.
Yeah. Well, it should be. It's an important factor because, of course, nitrogen fertilizers are critical to
right.
producing food. We need to use them, but we need to use them more carefully because anhydrous ammonium or any kind of ammonium-based nitrogen fertilizer is typically converted to nitrate in the soils. And that nitrate, that form of nitrogen called nitrate, is very mobile mm-hmm. and can move in solutions, can run off in water and into the rivers and streams and then eventually to the Gulf. It's very hard. I mean, it takes some knowledge, I guess you might say, to manage so that we reduce those losses of nitrogen from agricultural systems. But people can do that. They know how to do that. It requires some changing in management practices.
Well,
but it's possible to do it.
This is where your work is really getting to solutions,
mm-hmm.
yes, in terms of the way, I mean, obviously intensive agriculture is going to require that we use fertilizers. It's going to require that we use a number of technologies that we've developed that perhaps there's no turning back
that's right.
the clock
yeah.
on. But there are ways to manage those technologies so that the impacts, that the harmful impacts aren't so great.
I absolutely agree with that. And, of course, that's true whether we're talking about sewage effluents
yeah.
or animal waste or fertilizer in agriculture. But my own work has focused on managing fertilizer losses from agriculture. I'm really interested in studying how nitrogen moves between soil and water and plant and air systems. And I've had the opportunity to work with agronomists, agricultural scientists, and farmers and economists to ask why they make the decisions they make about using fertilizer, what the consequences of those decisions are, both in terms of growing more crop, but also in terms of losing nitrogen and having negative consequences for the environment. And we also are interested in asking what is economically and agronomically sensible for them to do, and yet to reduce the environmental consequences. We're looking in a way for the win-win solutions that make sense for the farmer and make sense for the environment at the same time. And in the work that we've done, and this, by the way, is not in the Mississippi Basin,
right?
But I think it's certainly applicable. We've found that the timing of fertilizer application, applying fertilizer closer to the time when crops really need it, is a very critical aspect of this, that farmers can actually apply a lot less nitrogen if they can apply it closer to the time that the crop will take it up. And that's one way to keep the nitrogen in the soil system rather than losing it mm-hmm. in water or to the air.
Well, for example, in the Yaqui Valley in
that's
Mexico?
That's right. That's in Sonora, Mexico.
Describe what you found there and what kind of the practice was being used there.
Okay. The Yaqui Valley is a very intensive agriculture. It is irrigated wheat and has some of the highest wheat yields in the world. It's a very successful area. And farmers in that environment grow wheat during the winter from November to April. And they typically apply around 250 pounds per acre or 250 kilograms per hectare of nitrogen as fertilizer. And, you know, that's a lot of nitrogen for a six-month crop. They apply most of it about a month before they plant the seeds, the wheat seeds. And after they apply it to dry soils, they irrigate. And then when things dry out enough, they get in and they plant the seeds. And what we've found is that during that one-month period before they plant their crops, they lose maybe a third of the nitrogen from the system completely. and they lose it to the atmosphere in a number of different forms, including NOx, the air pollutant I was talking about, and ammonia, and nitrous oxide, the greenhouse gas I was talking about. But they also lose a lot of it through leaching into the water systems. And those water systems drain directly into the Sea of Cortez, which is a very wonderful ecosystem off the coast of Mexico. And what we found in our work is that farmers have good reasons for doing this. This makes sense for them in terms of their allocation of labor, you know, getting some of the job out of the way before planting occurs. And they have a whole series of reasons why they do that that makes sense. But from the point of view of the biogeochemistry of the system, from the view of how nitrogen cycles in those plant soil systems, it's not a very good idea because they lose a lot of it. What we found is that if they can modify their planting practices so that they can apply fertilizer at the same time they plant, or at least part of their fertilizer at the same time they plant, they can dramatically reduce the amount of nitrogen that's lost from their systems. We found also that that could really be a substantial savings in money to them. They can save between 12 and 17% of after-tax profits if they switch to a system where they're applying less nitrogen, time to crop requirements. They get the same yields, the same grain quality, but they save money because they're not dumping the fertilizer down the drain, so to speak. And it seems to work there.
Does it add labor time or change the way the deal with work out in the field?
Right. The major impediment there was that they, if they were to try to fertilize and then plant with separate machine runs, basically, they would never have time to do that right at the same time of the year, right in the beginning of December when they want to plant. However, if they can modify their machinery so that they can both fertilize and plant at the same time, it becomes something that's very possible to do. Saves them money, as a matter of fact, because of less machine time. And some of the more progressive farmers in the valley discovered that really wasn't a hard thing to do with the resources they had. They could do that in their own backyards, basically. Of course, it's not always that easy. In this case, it was easy, and it was an easy change to make. That's not to say that all the farmers have made that change, but it's clear that it's possible. And one of the real benefits, I think, is that, for me, has been that I've been able to work with farmers who have real life to deal with there. You know, they have these considerations, and they're important considerations, but they've been willing to try, to think about doing things differently and to try different ways, different approaches.
Well, very good. We have a call to talk with, and we welcome others. We're getting close to the midpoint of our conversation already. Our guest during this hour is Pamela Mattson. She's director of the Earth Systems Program at Stanford University, and she is engaged in research on nitrogen cycling, trace gas exchange, and their impact on both agriculture and forest systems and on the global environment. And we're talking about a variety of issues pertaining to biogeochemistry. I just love saying that.
Yes.
And we welcome other callers. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Savoy on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good.
Say, we own and operate a farm down in southern Illinois, and I'd just like to kind of address the issue, of timing and nitrogen application rates. Down there at that farm, we use global positioning. It's we go and we monitor, where best to apply fertilizers in terms of phosphates, nitrogen, lime, and things of this nature. And we also go and we plant three varieties of corn, and each variety has its own specific nitrogen application rate, and we try and follow that very carefully. The other thing is almost all farmers in the United States have access to nitrogen securing systems. The most popular one is NSERV. There's others. And these systems are make the nitrogen very secure and much less mobile than what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And a nitrogen loss of 30% is intolerable. And nitrogen retention using NSERV is much greater than that, even over the fall.
Right.
And so I kind of question, you know, you may not be up to date with what modern farmers are doing here. In the United States, it's very sophisticated. And the nitrogen application rates are dropping, and the yields are going up. And they're going up for two reasons. One, the farmers are very sophisticated. The other thing is, too, that's going on, many farmers are putting in berms or, modifying their land slopes so that you don't have the runoff. And that's actually, you know, we went through that about 10 or 15 years ago, mainly as a yield improvement. And then the other thing is timing nitrogen application. That's real risky business. Here in North America, here in Champaign-Urbana, most people plant 120, 130-day corn. You can get weather patterns here in the Midwest that can prevent you from being in the field for as much as 10 to 14 days at a time. And I'll tell you what, you can lose a crop in the field just due to a bad rainstorm. And it does happen here in the
right.
Midwest.
It happens everywhere, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I wonder, how can we get around these problems? And, and I just wonder where you're coming up with these nitrogen loss.
Well, I think that, the things that you've just described are the right answers. Absolutely. And in a sense, if everyone did it the way you do it, it would be the example to the rest of the world. And one of the reasons that I'm working in Mexico right now is that I can tell you the rest of the world does not use those kinds of management practices. But I suspect that even here, even in the United States, there are plenty of examples of where, fertilizers are applied long in advance of planting with no nitrogen securing systems in place, and that a lot of nitrogen is lost before planting occurs. I suspect, although I haven't studied this myself, that you can find this in a lot of different places. I think that some of the things that you've addressed, the precision agriculture, basically paying attention to how much is applied in different areas of your fields and applying fertilizer at the rate that the system can use, is something that that is being really pioneered here and will eventually make its way around the world. I think the issue of securing nitrogen through inhibitors is a very useful idea, and we need to think about how to do that really well. What that actually does is prevent the conversion of ammonium to nitrate.
That's
And that nitrate is what's really mobile, really leaves the system easily.
Yeah, and the other thing is the crop rotation.
Right.
And then the selecting of the, we have access to the genetics that, we could go out and we typically sit down before we buy our corn and seed. We'll actually buy genetics based on two things. Mainly, one is we'll plant three different types of corn, mainly from a disease point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll also go and take into account the soil mapping that was obtained, after the fall harvest. So it is quite sophisticated.
It is. It's very information intensive, and it is really wonderful that there are examples of this and lots of examples of this. And it's useful for the rest of the world to hear about those examples and to see how it can be done.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think here in the United States, it's widespread, and that's technology. It's been known for a long time, and I just didn't, I couldn't sit here and say that it is very sophisticated, and I really think that we're more part of the solution than we are the problem.
Oh, I think so. I just am not absolutely sure that you're right that everybody's doing it. I think there's still a lot of progress to be made here too.
Well, hey, it's an interesting topic, and it's so important to us that we want to make sure that we get to the right answer. I'll tell you what, timing is very dangerous.
Now, I wanted to ask you a question about that. Is it possible? I know a lot of farmers in this area apply fertilizers in the fall, and some do with NSERV and some don't. As I understand, there are some studies that show that you can lose quite a bit in those early spring rains.
Yeah, you can.
No?
Yeah, you can. It is possible.
So I guess, is it possible to apply the fertilizer when you plant?
It can be. One of the problems is logistics. Many people buy their nitrogen in advance, and it's going to be delivered within a certain time frame. There's logistical problems even in the United States buying nitrogen. The other thing is if it's a multiple pass system over a field,
right?
That's where you have equipment availability problems with most farms, and it's the additional fuel cost and so on and so forth. I'm not aware of a combination planter nitrogen addition systems that are common, and it's mainly due to the logistics and the timing of it and the availability of equipment.
Yeah, those are all, you know, really reasonable problems, and I understand that that's the kind of thing that you're having to really work through all the time. I do hope, though, that it's not just a logistics in terms of, you know, when the fertilizer is available from the fertilizer companies or what the cost is, the prices for the fertilizer in fall versus spring.
Here in the Midwest, fertilizer comes up by barge, and then it's transported by pipeline to storage facilities, at the major distribution points. You can see those as you drive around. There's one down by Posotum. There's a very large ammonia storage facility down there where it's stored at atmospheric pressure and liquefied. And there's another one over here at Danville. There's one at Beardstown and so on and so forth. And I'll tell you what, there's a mad rush.
I can imagine.
And get it delivered.
Yeah. Well, That I can see as a part of the story, but that might be one of the parts of the story that we have to figure out how to change.
If you have what we call a better distribution, you know, more points of distribution, what you're talking about becomes more feasible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Hey, we'll see you later.
Okay.
Yeah, bye.
Well, thank you very much for the call and the points you made.
That was very useful.
One of the issues that was raised, timing, is a big issue. But here in the Midwest, as I understand it, one of the problems in getting the timing right is that the weather can affect the rates of available nitrogen based on, you know, how warm the soil temperature is and how happy the microbes are that are fixing the nitrogen.
That's true. But I also think that the weather plays a major issue here in terms of risk, in terms of actually getting in into the fields, and so there are sort of two weather related issues. The temperature effect on the microbial processes is an important one. If you put say urea down on a dry soil where there's not enough moisture, it'll just sit there. If you put anhydrous in and it's cold, it might just sit there because the microbial processes are slow. And so, yes, the temperature matters. I think sometimes we rely on, when we put things down in the fall, we rely on it being cold enough. You know, the soil's cold, nothing's going to happen. But, of course, we all know that we get these surprise periods of warm weather in December and things like that we can't control. So I think there's a possibility of losing nitrogen from systems when we expect that they're going to be cold and they're not. But then on the flip side, that issue of timing of fertilizer for to meet crop demands, synchronous with crop demands, it's a difficult one because if you hold back your fertilizer and assume that you'll be able to get onto the field any old time you want, you could be put back for weeks by an unusually wet spell, and that could result in loss of yields and thus economic loss for the farmers. Eventually that might be something that has to be dealt with to recognize that they're taking risks. If we were to move to a system where we apply fertilizer more carefully timed to crop requirements, there would be years where there'd be a loss, and there has to be some fallback, some support for that, if indeed that becomes an objective for us in order to reduce nitrogen emissions and losses.
We're talking this morning with Dr. Pamela Mattson. She's director of the Earth Systems Program at Stanford University in the School of Earth Sciences. She's an ecologist and biogeochemist, and we're talking about nitrogen cycling in the agricultural system and in the global system. And there are some other questions that I have, but we have a listener waiting, and I will defer to them. I'll mention the phone numbers again. We have just about 15 minutes left during this hour. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. 800-222-9455, anywhere else. Let's talk with another listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Our family has a farm in Ohio, and we've fenced the creek that runs through it so that the farmer who run some heifers on our pasture land so his cows don't get into the creek. I'm wondering how much of that sort of thing contributes to nitrogen. I wasn't involved in dealing with that issue. Somebody who's more involved with water stuff in our family arranged for that. I don't know whether it was because of bacteria wanting to keep that out or nitrogen keeping it out of the stream.
The use of vegetated strips along streams and wetlands along streams is really very important in terms of trapping nitrogen that leaves agricultural systems in water. And so one objective is to keep as many of those stream environments sort of vegetated so they're not being trampled and not just mud. And the more vegetation you have along those drainages, the greater the chance that you'll have retention of nitrogen. And researchers here at the University of Illinois have shown that it can be very effective in maybe removing 50% of the nitrogen that's leaving the agricultural systems. So I think basically managing those streamside areas is a very, very important part of the process here, a very important component of the solution. And part of that, of course, is then keeping cattle out of the streams and keeping them from trampling and disturbing the stream environment itself, too.
Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of Amish in the neighborhood and who don't fence the streams and whose cattle just wander right through the stream farther down. And I'm wondering, is there any difference in the way that groups that farm in, I don't know if you want to use the term more traditional ways in the U.S. In terms of nitrogen load in streams, do you have any data on that?
I don't have any information on that. I know that there are very different ways of managing. I think it's important to remember that some of the same groups that might allow cattle in their streams also might not apply very much fertilizer. So I mean, it's possible to have those kinds of trade-offs, and I really don't know enough about it to be able to speak to it. I will say, though, that I think the solution to this is to think about both what's happening on your fields, but also what's happening on the landscape. And so taking a multiple approach to it, both by reducing or increasing efficiency of your fertilizer use in crops, and also using vegetation buffers and wetlands and things like that to help remove anything that actually does leave the system is a good sort of double-pronged approach to it. And thinking about that whole system rather than just what's happening in one piece of it is useful.
Agriculture is very different from place to place in the U.S., and it's quite different here than it is in an area that's dairy-rich
right,
or more rolling and so forth. And I'm just beginning to learn about all this stuff. Thanks.
Thank you. Now, agriculture really is different in different places of the U.S. as well as around the world. And so it becomes very difficult to generalize about, what we should do in this given spot. It really requires, I think, a collaboration among researchers, extension agents, growers and farmers to try to develop what really are the best practices for the given environment.
Well, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you to speak to, and that is the interdisciplinary approach necessary to deal with some of these issues with so much focused scientific work being done in mm-hmm. particular areas, unless there's some, cross talk or collaboration between those scientists and the people who live and work in
right.
a given environment, then it's perhaps hard to really come up with a workable solution.
I agree. I think it's all too easy for someone like me to go out and study a field or study a watershed and come up with some solutions that might be completely irrelevant to the people who live there and work the land. And it makes a lot of sense for teams of people to work together. I think I, as a biogeochemist, bring a certain set of information and knowledge to a project. I can tell someone about when they're losing their nitrogen and what form it's in and what they might do to retain it. But that's about all I can do by myself. And working with agronomists who are concerned about the crop itself and how much nitrogen is retained and available to the crop when the crop needs it, that's a very critical part of it. Working with the farmers who say what the logistics problems are that they're dealing with and what's feasible and not feasible, that's important. Working with agricultural economists who can think about what's happening in this spot in relation to sort of macroeconomics, global economics, is also really an important part of it. And my sense is that that we're moving in this direction of integrative research and problem solving, in a sense that we're beginning to recognize that working together is probably going to get us farther than, you know, sort of working individually and trying to throw all the information together at the end. And I know that with respect to this issue of fertilizer and nitrogen loading in streams and those kinds of things, we've realized, people across the country have realized, that we need to seek for common ground here. We need to look for ways that we can understand different points of view and actually work together to develop solutions rather than just sort of finger pointing.
Very good. We've got several callers waiting, and we'll get on next to a listener in Pasotum on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, good morning. I enjoy your show, and I enjoy your guest. Unlike she knows what she's talking about and is fair with the whole her assessment of the situation. I farm, too, and I'm aware of the problem of using nitrogen and the timing and so forth. But I'm curious, if you're aware, is there any work being done to genetically engineer corn so that it will fix its own nitrogen that, like soybeans do?
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware of any of that going on? That would seem to solve a lot of problems. It may put a lot of people out of business.
Yeah.
It would solve a lot of the runoff problems.
It definitely would. Their genetic engineering gets a bad rap, but that I think there are some really positive things that could come out of it, like this one. Yes, there is work going on right now to attempt to add the nitrogen-fixing machinery into corn, but I think that this is a very long-term job. It's very difficult because the way nitrogen fixation works in plants is not just one enzyme that does the job, but the plant needs to protect the enzyme through structures, keep oxygen away from the enzymes. The plant needs to be able to transport the nitrogen that's fixed out of that area where it's being fixed by the microbes. It's a difficult and complex kind of machinery in plants. And when I've talked with the molecular biologists who are working on this problem, they don't hold out hope for an immediate solution here. But there are other things that can be explored, like increasing the efficiency by which plants use nitrogen so that they can, you know, produce as much grain but with less nitrogen. And those kinds of questions are also being explored.
Mm-hmm. How about genetically engineering the bacteria itself that fixes the nitrogen? Is there work being done there?
No, it's more trying to engineer in the ability for the plant to provide a home for the bacteria that fix the nitrogen.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the conversation. It's a good show.
Thanks very much for the call.
Okay.
We have our lines are all full, so we'll continue and talk with some more listeners. This is someone in Champaign on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. I was wondering if you could say something about the role of the fertilizer sale companies. You are, after all, suggesting that they make less money. And I'd be interested to see what their attitude is to education and reformulation of how you apply fertilizer. And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks.
Well, that's a very, very important and interesting question. I'm not sure I have a complete answer to it. Again, this is one that probably varies all over the world. I know in the places that I've worked in northern Mexico, the fertilizer industry plays a very major role in providing the advice about how much fertilizer to use. And that advice is not always similar to the advice that the agricultural extension agents there would give. In the United States, I really don't know. I have talked with the Fertilizer Association, the fertilizer industry, and been listened to with respect. I think they recognize that there are issues that need to be thought about and dealt with, and that can't be just swept under a rug. I think they're hopefully treating this responsibly, too. In the end, it's hard to say whether they're going to lose money or not. The need for fertilizer is going to grow worldwide. We're adding another couple billion people, and we have to feed those people. And so we have to produce a lot of food. And over the next 50 or 60 years, the need for fertilizer globally is not going to go down. Hopefully it won't go up too much, but if we can use it more efficiently than we do now. But I don't think they're, you know, globally speaking, they're going to lose their buyers. Mm-hmm. The other aspect of that, of course, I suppose, is that fertilizers could become more expensive, which would be, involve a hardship for farmers. And, right. But at any rate, my sense is that the fertilizer industry is paying attention to this and is sort of figuring it in their long-term survivorship.
We have a couple calls waiting. There's one question, though, that I sort of feel we need to, pose, because we haven't really talked about the impact of nitrogen on global climate change. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the areas that you have focused on. And we've talked about, runoff in waterways, but there are also there's runoff into the atmosphere.
Right. Yes. There are emissions of gases, in particular nitrous oxide, which is a very effective greenhouse gas. It is very good at trapping radiation coming off the Earth's surface, being reflected back out to space, and holding it in our atmosphere, thereby warming the atmosphere. So when we think about future climate change, of course, we focus on carbon dioxide because it's the number one greenhouse gas. We're producing that by burning coal and oil and gas. But we're also producing some other greenhouse gases that are good greenhouse gases in terms of their ability to trap air and warm the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Greenhouse gas nitrous oxide is produced naturally by microorganisms in soils and also in water systems. But it has been increasing very rapidly over the last 50 to 100 years. And that increase is quite clearly related to the increase in nitrogen in the global system, and especially to fertilization. Fertilized agricultural systems are the number one single source of that increase of nitrous oxide in the atmosphere. So, again, it's not a huge amount that's produced, but it plays a very important role in the atmosphere. And it's one that we don't pay a lot of attention to because gases like carbon dioxide are more important. Mm-hmm. But it's one where we can, again, by managing fertilizer, dramatically reduce the loss of that gas and sort of help out in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, forgive me, because there are several different forms of nitrogen we've talked here. And this is nitrous oxide?
Yes.
Okay.
This is N2O.
N2O.
Yes.
But it also plays a role in stratospheric ozone depletion?
That's correct. Nitrous oxide really doesn't do anything in the lower part of the atmosphere. It accumulates there, and it traps this radiation coming off the Earth's surface, and therefore it's a greenhouse gas. But eventually, slowly but surely, it makes its way into the upper part of the atmosphere, the stratosphere. And in that part of the atmosphere, it's involved in breaking down ozone, the good kind of ozone that we have high up in the atmosphere that protects all of us from UV radiation and from ultraviolet radiation. So it plays a kind of a double environmental role. In the lower part of the atmosphere, it's a greenhouse gas. Once it makes its way up into the upper part of the atmosphere, it helps to break down ozone, and that causes us problems with increasing ultraviolet radiation hitting the Earth.
And so we're faced with a scenario where, with agriculture developing, modern agriculture throughout the world using the methods that we have used here, there is the danger, perhaps likelihood, that there would be an increase in this N2O in the atmosphere through that vector.
Absolutely. There's very clear evidence that if fertilization can lead to and does often lead to in high emissions of that gas. Therefore, when we project the increasing use of fertilizer over the next 20 or 30 or 50 years, we also project an increasing emission of that greenhouse gas. But as I say, there are ways that we can manage that. The same management practices that reduce nitrate leaching losses are likely to reduce nitrous oxide emissions. So we get a double benefit by worrying about keeping nitrogen on the soil, on the land.
Very good. We have a couple calls waiting, and I'll try to get, we'll see if we can get them both in, but we'll go first to listener in Chicago on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. At the end of World War II, a lot of the airplane hangars were left empty, and they decided to convert them to a hydroponic or aquaculture for growing produce and things, and it supplied the general needs of the area. Is aquaculture or hydroponics offer a medium or safe way of production of food that you know of?
I think that certainly it contributes, but it's not feasible for feeding 6 billion people.
That.
I think that's the bottom line. Everything helps, and developing organic approaches may not be something that we're going to do worldwide tomorrow.
No,
but we can begin to move in that direction and make progress. But I think we do have to sort of keep at the bottom. The most fundamental point is that we do have to feed a growing human population, but we have to figure out how to do that and at the same time to reduce those negative consequences.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. And we'll try to squeeze in one last caller in Eureka, but have to unfortunately ask that caller to be quick. Good morning.
Oh, could you just make a general comment about extended release fertilizer? You know, like in medications, you can get extended release medication. Work being done?
Time release
nitrogen. Time release nitrogen. It would be wonderful if we could use that. It has been evaluated, and the answer, at least that I heard a few years ago, was it's too expensive. But I think when we start adding up all of the other costs that we're paying because of this, maybe it's not too expensive. So it's something that we should be trying to develop. It's also possible we can develop new approaches that won't make it be so expensive. That would be perfect because fertilizers would then be released synchronized to plant uptake, and that would solve a lot of our problems.
We're here at the end of our time, so we're going to have to stop, but I'll suggest for listeners, if you're in the area, if you'd like to hear more, and this is an important issue to you, and I'm sure it's important to all of us, but many people are very directly involved in it. Dr. Pamela Mattson will be speaking later today at 4 o'clock in the Chemical and Life Sciences Laboratory building, 601 South Goodwin, and that's room B102. It's a lot of information in there, but if you can call our office and we'll make sure you get the right information if you're interested in attending. I'm sure you'd be welcome. And Dr. Mattson, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio adjacent to Campbell Hall for public telecommunication. Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the massage therapy professionals at Bodywork Associates of Champaign. Bodywork Associates has been providing practical relief for tired, aching muscles since 1982. Just to mention, tomorrow morning on Focus 580, during the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about student testing and educational accountability, a subject that is of great interest, certainly in the schools and also politically these days. Our guest will be Robert Lynn. He's co-director of the National Center for Research on Evaluations, Standards, and Student Testing at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's in town to give a Millocom lecture. Then at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, we'll talk about the Stardust Program and deep space exploration with Kenneth Atkins, a longtime manager at Jet Propulsion Laboratory and a former project manager for JPL's Stardust program. So that's what's coming up tomorrow on the show. We'll leave it there for today. Time to hand things off to Tom Rogers, hosting today's Afternoon Magazine. Tom?
Good afternoon, Jack. On our show today and the 1 o'clock hour, who is holding because we've used the time. We very sincerely at WILL care what you think about the programming. You can write us. You can call us. The people at NPR do feel the same. You can get in touch with him a variety of ways.
Yes, you can call me or write me, or better yet, talk to the ombudsman. But if you want to write me or send me an email, it's kklose, K-K-L-O-S-E, at npr.org. And our address in Washington by snail mail is NPR, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001.
All right. Thanks very much. Our guest this morning, Kevin Close. He's president and CEO of National Public Radio.